The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Zuruti.
And welcome to this week's Red Handed. Before we kick off with probably the grossest case we've done in quite some time, we're doing a live show in April. Where are we now? February. It's coming up in a couple of months. It's going to be at Wilton's Music Hall, which is a stunning venue. And it's part of Podcast Live, Crime. And there'll be us and like a couple of other shows.
And even if you're like, I don't really give a shit about seeing you guys live, just come for the venue. It's so pretty. I'm really
come for
it.
The crime, stay for the venue.
Exactly. Maybe come for the venue, stay for the crime. You know, people who aren't even into crime, bring them because they'll fucking love the venue. It's so beautiful. It's on all those like time out lists of like secret date spots. Not that I have ever had a date there, but it's on there.
My friend got married there. So they do all of that.
That's the best kind of date.
Yeah, it's in the East End. It's one of the last standing music halls in the country, like the original music halls from the days of yore. And it is very beautiful. So come and have a look at that and also us. And we will leave you a link for the tickets in the episode description. It is on the 7th of April. Fucking hell, you can tell I haven't plugged a live show in a while. Jesus Christ.
Blah, 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 blah.
Blubbity, 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 blah. Yeah, buy your tickets.
You guys get it. The link's in the episode description. All the information you need is there. We're going to be there. That's all you need to know. Other than that, one other announcement before we head on with today's stomach churning case is $10 up patrons or potential $10 up patrons. You will see that you have had that we have dropped February's bonus episode on Monday. It's on the quite heartbreaking case of an 8-year-old girl called Jean Carhartfuel. She was an orphan who came to America from Hong Kong and tragically is one day found hanging from a tree. If you'd like to, if you want to find out what happened there and also the justice that was served up for another young girl who was murdered about a quarter of a century later, then head on over to Patreon and you can have a listen there. And also, if you're a $5 up patron, stay tuned for the end of the show where we will talk about something in Under the Duvet.
We are making some changes to our Patreon structure, and that means that $5 and up patrons, if you have not signed up by the 20th of February, you will not be getting stickers. We're stopping doing stickers, but we're replacing it with a lot more content. So if you sign up before the 20th of February, you will get a sticker. If you do not, you won't. Simple as that.
Literally as simple as that. That's it. But if you do sign up after the 20th of February, or literally at any time, the great news is you will get access to the full back catalogue of Patreon content. Everybody messages us and asks us that. This is that clarification. You will immediately get access to everything. So sign up now and just have a good old gorge on all that true crime loveliness that we've got up there.
And speaking of gorging, yeah. This is probably not a gorging episode. I think I'm actually going to have to issue our first no eating warning of 2020. And it's not so much for like body horror gore reasons. It's more just like deep seated total disgust and disbelief.
Yeah, I mean, incest, abuse isn't the natural side dish to any meal, I would say. So don't make it yours today.
No, don't do it. You'll really regret it. We're also going to have to talk about armpits. So get excited. I'm like gagging already. Okay, so lots of things happened in 1946. And a particularly bad one was the birth of Marcus Dellen Wesson. His dad was a violent alcoholic and his mum was a fanatical Seventh-day Adventist who whipped her four children with electrical cord until they bled. She passed her fanaticism on to her son, who liked to play preacher more than he did anything else. He modelled himself on the preachers he saw in and around Kansas, and he wore a shirt and tie to school and told all of his classmates that he was the leader of their lost flock.
I think at this point, he could go on to just become very enterprising, but he takes a bad turn here.
Yeah, he could have gone on to be a motivational speaker.
Exactly, exactly. I was reading this and I was like, all right, fine. I was kind of a power-hungry kid. I see what's going on here. But
what? Did you just preach to people in the playground and be like, don't worry, I have been sent to you to save you?
No, but I was having like quite a vivid memory of this the other day when I was talking about it with my parents. When I was like in year five, I want to say, I did quite a lot of extracurricular reading on the Egyptians because it was interesting. And I became quite obsessed with Cleopatra. And I thought, how can I manufacture a situation in which I get to dress up like Cleopatra and be Cleopatra and tell everybody about the things I've read about her? So I got a bunch of the other kids to be in a play I wrote about Cleopatra, in which I cast myself as the lead role, and then got our teacher to agree to let me put the performance on to everybody.
You are a tyrant. How is that possible? Oh, why was your teacher leading such unstructured lessons that she was like, oh yeah, don't worry about it, guys. We've got to spare 3 hours for Saruti's one-woman show.
Literally. And it was a he. It was Mr. Canoe. Mr. Canoe? Mr. Cano. Mr. Cano. Sorry. We used to call him Mr. Canoe. I don't think he knew. But I don't know. I think I was just, precocious and power hungry. And slightly tyrannical. I got to dress up like Cleopatra. There was a bit where I got rolled up in a carpet. The other people stood around and like waved blue silk while I was like on voyages. It was great. It was a good show.
Was that in your stage directions?
It was in my stage directions. And who knows, maybe Wilton's Music Hall will be getting a encore of my year five play on Cleopatra. Who knows? I'll turn up and surprise you.
On your fucking own, mate. If you show up with some silk, I am going home.
Oh my God. Well, the people won't go home. I think they're there for it. So who knows? The surprise. It's a story swap at Wilton. So Hannah doesn't know what case I'm doing and I don't know what she's doing. So maybe I'm going to do Cleopatra.
That famous East End story.
But anyway, the point is, at this point, he could have just gone on to become a famous podcaster. Famous? Did I let that slip out?
Whoa.
He could have gone on to become a very humble, mediocre podcaster.
He was quite virtuous in a lot of ways. He never drank a drop of alcohol and he steered clear of drugs completely. And Marcus Wesson would keep up this attitude his whole life. And when he couldn't convince people that he was important, he decided that he would make a flock of his own that wouldn't be able to leave him. He did achieve this goal as a grown-up, but before he was a grown-up, he went into the army at just 17. He worked as an ambulance driver, possibly in Vietnam, unconfirmed. He didn't manage to complete high school. He was honorably discharged in 1968 and set up his post-army life in San Jose, California, where he met Rosemary Maturina. She was 13 years older than him and had 8 children from various baby daddies. None of this bothered young Marcus Wesson. He moved in with Rosemary and all of her many children. Rosemary's cousin was struggling with a drug addiction, so she dropped off all of her kids at that house too, which meant that in total there were 16 people living in that house.
And that is certainly a flock of some kind. But Marcus wasn't satisfied, and he took a particular interest in Rosemary's 8-year-old daughter, Elizabeth. And for those of you in the know, obviously a particular interest in this specific instance unfortunately means sexual abuse. Wesson claimed that his own father had sexually abused him, but there doesn't seem to be much evidence to support that, so it's hard to know whether it was true or not. But given some of the other things that we do know or have heard about his father, we do think that it is likely true. According to Wesson's sister, their father was very quote-unquote affectionate when he was drunk, and the children knew to hide from him when he was in that state. A childhood friend of Wesson's also claimed that Marcus's father had once offered him $50 for oral sex. His friend was a child at the time the offer was made. So I'm leaning towards the idea that there was sexual abuse in the Wesson household. And one thing we definitely do know is that Marcus Wesson's father ran off with his own cousin and the two continued a homosexual relationship for 10 years. After that decade was over, he returned back to his family home and took up again with his wife and children, like nothing had ever happened.
So I think sexual abuse of young children and also incest is just something that, like, no. Not that this is excusing what he's doing, but it was present in his childhood.
Yeah, it seems to have been quite normalised in a way that it ever can be. And given everything that we do know or that other people say about Marcus Wesson's father, I do very much think that Marcus Wesson was abused. But obviously, as you say, that is no excuse for what he goes on to do.
So I can understand why 17-year-old Marcus dropped out of school and joined the army, but we are not defending what happened next. Marcus Wesson would abuse Elizabeth for decades in the sickest way possible. He claimed that God had told him that Elizabeth was meant to be his wife. So at just 8 years old, Elizabeth was put through a pretend wedding ceremony in the front room of her family home with her mum's boyfriend. Elizabeth was then taken out of school so she could spend every second with Wesson. When she was 12 years old, he ramped up his abuse. Elizabeth was pregnant at 14 years old, and apparently the legal limit for marriage at the time was 15, but Elizabeth was not going to make it. So Wesson told everyone that he had her mother's permission, which he did not, and he married her for real, legally, in real life.
I mean, I don't know. Telling everybody that you have permission, it just, is that enough? Fucking hell.
Doesn't she need to sign something? Like, what?
So he's 17 and she's 8 when they first...
No, he's in his 20s. He's back from the army.
Oh, God. Yeah, so this is what I'm saying. Like, how is just saying that you have the mum's permission enough? This is outrageous. Like, why... The fact that he even tells people that, like, and doesn't just lie and say, we don't know who got her pregnant, but I'm going to look after her. Like, ugh.
Honestly, this case feels so incomprehensible in so many ways. And what the major way is how he managed to marry a 14-year-old child who was visibly pregnant and no one thought it was weird or tried to stop him. After the wedding, Marcus Wesson and Elizabeth still lived with Rosemary, that's Elizabeth's mum, and the other bajillion people in that house. Elizabeth and Marcus took up residence on the top floor of the house and Rosemary was at the bottom. Eventually, Marcus stole Rosemary's van and left. And he took Elizabeth with him. And it's so difficult. This is the other thing. It's so difficult to know what terminology is right to use here. Like, calling it a marriage feels wrong. Calling it a relationship feels wrong. Calling it anything other than abuse feels wrong. But it's difficult to, like, because they are legally married and they do go on to have children, it's so hard to know the right thing to say or the right way to phrase it.
So this abuse went on for years, and Elizabeth would give birth to 10 of Marcus Wesson's children before she was 26. 10 children before she's 26. My God. I've just been listening to the Kelly Lane podcast, and she had like 6 kids by the time she was 26. And, you know, obviously that wasn't down to abuse, but fucking hell, I just don't know how. How is that possible?
I just can't wrap my head around it. Like, I have no, and this is, you know, that's obviously my own privilege, but like, I just have no concept.
No.
I can't relate to it in any way.
So Marcus and Elizabeth continued the van life for as long as they feasibly could. Marcus worked in a bank for a short stint, but it didn't suit him. So he continued to be a nomad collecting welfare benefits to survive. Elizabeth kept having more and more children, so Marcus finally had the flock that he'd always been waiting for. And again here, like Hannah was saying, what the right terminology is quite difficult. It all feels wrong. Saying the word family feels wrong, but I'm not sure what else to say. So as the family grew, Marcus moved them all around the country. And they lived in every type of accommodation possible that wasn't an actual house. They lived in tugboats that were rusted through. They spent 12 years living in a large army tent. They had no running water, no electricity, and they even lived in a shed behind a burnt-out property for a while. No one noticed, and no one tried to stop them. Okay, so it's important at this point to say that Marcus Wesson is African-American, and so are his children. I'm not going to say that this wouldn't and hasn't happened to poor white children and poor white families, because it absolutely has. I've watched many a troubling documentary like it. But in this case, did the fact that they were African American play into their invisibility? Almost 100%.
And when they get moved on from sheds or whatever, it's never because anyone's worried about what's happening. No one ever calls the social services. They literally, he just won't pay them, so they kick him out. Like, it's not, it's always financial. It's nothing to do with the fact of what he's doing.
And isn't that the travesty, that everybody is more concerned about whether they were getting paid or whether their property was being, you know, hijacked or squatted on than they were for what is at one point 10 children and their welfare.
Even more, yeah. Even more, because the children start having children. Yeah. Predictably, when Marcus's daughters got to about 8 years old, he started to sexually abuse them, just like he'd done with their mum, Elizabeth. And I wish it stopped there, but it didn't. As he aged, Marcus Wesson became more and more paranoid and more reliant on religious doctrine. But even the most hardline Seventh-day Adventist ideals were not quite enough for Marcus Wesson, and he started to form his own religious message. The key themes were that he was God, obviously, that he was also Jesus, and that he was also a vampire.
Because why not? Why not? Maybe it was like, well, with, yeah, me and Cleopatra. He just did some reading. He did some extracurricular reading on vampires outside of the Bible and the Seventh-day Adventist doctrines and just decided, yeah, let's also do that. I kind of fancy being a vampire and I kind of fancy making all these people have to go through that. Bet he didn't have some blue silk though, did he?
You'd be surprised. Marcus Wesson was convinced that he was actually a vampire. God and vampires are both immortal beings. So obviously that meant that they were the same. Honestly, the logic on this man is just something else. And there was one major difference between Marcus vampires and normal vampires. Marcus and his followers all had souls. So even though they were vampires, they could walk around in daylight without turning into dust. I'm not really sure how he managed to negotiate that particular benefit with the Vampire Council, but he managed. If you're just going to decide that you're a supernatural being, can you just be like, oh yeah, I want all of those bits, but I'd like to be able to go outside in daytime, please?
Yeah. I mean, like, he's a very persuasive, abusive man, isn't he? He moved into a woman's house and then just took her 8-year-old daughter and married her. If anyone's going to convince the Vampire Council that he can walk around in daylight, it's this guy.
And while we're talking about the obviously made up Vampire Council... let's take a quick folklore break. I have had this in the back of my mind for ages, but I looked it up this week. Apparently there's a Hebrew legend that Judas Iscariot was the father of all vampires, as in like the first ever one, which is why vampires are sensitive to silver, because of the 30 silver pieces that Judas received for making sure Jesus came second in the Galilee carpentry competition in 30 CE or something.
Is this a side plug for Helen Hot Takes with Hannah Maguire?
Yeah.
Good.
Just come and listen to me make up Bible stories.
I think it's there. I think there's a market for it, Hannah.
Hey, I thought that was interesting, though, about Judas being the first vampire.
Mm.
But Marcus Wesson overlooked this connection to vampires being the literal opposite of Jesus and told all of his children and his wife that they were vampires too.
And it doesn't stop there, I'm afraid. Because Marcus was also convinced that polygamy was necessary for the vampire king, and that incest was the best way to create the purest version of yourself. He was also convinced that Jesus was a womanizer, so he married his daughters and nieces and had children with all of them. Just like he had done with Elizabeth, he would have a strange little ceremony with a young girl, which involved a lot of hand-holding. And afterwards, he would give each girl a wedding ring and a gold necklace. Where he's getting the money for all this jewellery, I don't know. Because
they're literally starving and surviving on food stamps and welfare benefits. I don't know where this... I mean, maybe he was just nicking them. I don't know. But like, it seems so strange. There's so many things about this case that feel completely impossible. It was really weird to research it. It just seems impossible that this went on and no one noticed.
But have you seen that? There is a documentary on YouTube. I mean, I don't know. It's like a Real Stories one. And it's about that polygamist. I want to say he's a Mormon. I can't remember. But he lives out in the desert with just like a bunch of caravans round in a circle. And he just marries his women. And if they've got daughters from other marriages, he'll like marry the daughter as well. And he's got like 20 wives. And... they all just live out there and no one's doing anything about it. It just seems...
But they live in the middle of nowhere.
No. And these guys are living like in a very urban setting. Like,
yeah, totally. I mean, they end up in Fresno, in a city.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, there are like long periods of time where they're like out in the woods or whatever, and like, but it's not like, I think it's called something flats, that like Mormon community. It's literally in the middle of the desert and they all live in the rock and like have 17 wives.
There's that one which Channel 4 made the documentary about, which is now on Netflix, called like One Husband, Three Wives or something.
Yeah, smash that
but
shit.
But no, the one I'm talking about is like super old and it's not a community. It's just one guy with a bunch of wives.
Right.
Like, I'll post it on the Facebook group or social media, whatever. It's fucking nuts. But yeah, no, I totally take your point. These guys are in a much more like obvious city location, and how they're slipping under the radar. I don't know how any of these people slip under the radar. Fuck it all. It's terrifying.
It's terrifying because nobody did anything to stop it. Many neighbors even admitted they didn't know that Marcus Wesson had any children. And he's literally haven't been able to pinpoint like an actual solid number of how many kids he was living with. But he was living with all of the 10 children that he and Elizabeth had. Those children had children. And then all of Elizabeth's like nieces and nephews all were living with them as well. So it's literally probably 20 or close to, maybe even more. And these people are saying they didn't know he had any children. Fucking bullshit.
No, I don't buy that they didn't know he had any children. I can absolutely believe that they didn't know how many children he had, because I'm sure these kids are very quiet in the house. And I can also assume that probably a lot of them weren't allowed outside a lot. But to say you didn't know he had any children seems a stretch.
When the children were allowed out in public, which was not very often, they had to walk behind Marcus and they weren't allowed to speak. And they also had to wear modest clothes and cover their heads. That's the women, obviously. One shopkeeper recalled thinking that they were very strange, these girls that had come into his shop covering their heads and wearing modest dresses, and that they bought a lot of ramen noodles. But again, he didn't report it. I mean, what would you report for that? But it's so obvious that something's wrong, because he said that he remembered the girls looking like they were hungry and haunted.
And there is absolutely no record that the Wesson family were ever investigated by social services. But Wesson most certainly was investigated for welfare fraud. He wrote the IRS an 80-page letter explaining that he was actually the one investigating them. And he was doing it all under the name of Black and White Times actor Richard Widmark. I mean, honestly, Marcus Wesson is unhinged, I think we can say, the way he's behaving. He writes to the fucking IRS and tells them he's investigating them. What's happening?
It's ridiculous. He's just like, oh, no. Let me explain this to you. You've got the wrong end of the stick.
And you could say, like, perhaps he's delusional. I mean, potentially. But then we do go on to see, as this episode unravels, there are times when he's very coherent and he knows when to be quiet. He knows how to comply. He knows how to be cooperative. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on with this guy.
It's really hard to say. Like, I think saying he's got no mental health issues is probably a bit of a stretch.
No.
But
is he totally detached from reality? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. And also the things he does are so horrible. And like being able to manipulate other people to such an extent, It just makes you so, not that I'm saying that you should have any sympathy for him at all, but like, it's just hard to see it in any other way. So it makes it more difficult to frame it in like a mental health way. Does that make sense? I don't, like, it's difficult to talk about him as an ill man because of the things he's done.
Yes. Unsurprisingly, of course, all of the children were homeschooled and they were taught to fear authority and especially the police. Marcus wrote his own scripture, of course, featuring himself as the vampire god king.
Does that remind anyone of anybody? Anybody writing things and then putting themselves in the starring role? Anyone at all?
There seem to be alarming parallels. Perhaps Marcus was a slight bit more creative than I was, because he called himself Javan Marc Suspri, whereas I just was Cleopatra, so, you know. And Marcus also really liked the bits of the Bible, unsurprisingly, that encouraged polygamy. And he copied these bits into his own scripture, which he called the Night of the Light for the Dark. That's quite good. I'll give him.
Is it? I can't stand it. It's like, it's so faux gothic romantic. I hate it.
It's like a great name for a Tumblr page. for someone
yeah, exactly.
who's like writing their own nouveau gothic horror.
Twilight something. Yeah.
Twilight fan fiction.
Yeah, yeah, exactly that, exactly that.
And obviously Marcus, as anybody who writes their own scriptures, told all of his children that the book was total fact and that it was filled with things that had already happened and with things that were yet to come.
All of his children were completely under his control. A lot of people call this a cult, and I'm a bit on the fence about what I think about that, but there are definitely cultish characteristics all over the place. For example, the outlandish made-up religion is obviously a big one, even though you could argue that all religions are in fact made up.
And outlandish.
Well, exactly. And then he's obviously controlling his children and his wife at every move. They didn't go to school, so they could be filled up with his narrative of an omnipotent vampirism. Marcus Wesson demanded that all of the people who lived with him call him Lord and Master. He refused to work, so they had no money, which meant they ate less, which meant they had less energy and were more malleable. Marcus did not starve himself. He weighed almost 300 pounds because he gorged on junk food all the time. And he also had waist-length grey dreadlocks that his family fought over maintaining. We know that the preferred term is locks. We just wanted to make sure that people knew what we were talking about. It's kind of just one giant one that's like really massive. So his family fought over maintaining that. And they also fought about who would be able to scratch his armpits. That was like top task.
As obviously stomach churning as that is, I think when you really look into the level of abuse and power he is maintaining over these people, obviously those are disgusting, very too intimate. I'm going to say, I don't want to scratch anybody's armpit, even if I'm in love with you. Let's not do that. That seems fine. And like, we could possibly have a very happy relationship without us ever having to engage in that. But what I'm saying is like, this is it. He's making these people, these children, these women who he is abusing, fight for his attention and fight for his approval by degrading themselves to the max. Like, we're fighting over doing this, of course, because who can win his favor? Who can get beaten the least? Who can get raped the least? Who might get fed a little bit more? It is the ultimate sense of power that this man has. And in a fitting way, Marcus was also obsessed with the Branch Davidians and their leader, David Koresh. He believed that they were truly God's people and that the American government was an oppressive entity interfering with religious freedom and God's will. David Koresh's multiple wives and many children were right up Marcus Wesson's street. He made his family watch every second of the 51-day siege of the Waco, Texas compound in 1993. And he started to think quite a lot about mass suicide.
He loves David Koresh so much. He's literally like watching every second of it and being like, that is how it should be. That is what we should aspire to be doing, is living in a massive compound and just like having loads of babies.
And that's exactly what he was doing with Elizabeth, having lots and lots of children. But obviously, Marcus and Elizabeth did not only have daughters. They also had sons in the Wesson boat, tent, and sheds that they had been living in. These boys that they had a very different life to the girls. For a start, they weren't forced to marry their dad. They were also allowed to train in martial arts and had quite a bit more freedom. They were, however, beaten, though. One son described being whipped with an electrical cord for 20 minutes every day for 30 days because he sneaked a teaspoon of peanut butter and got caught. Marcus obviously had a lot less time for his sons, and he became concerned as they got older that they would steal his vampire child brides from him. So he wrote a 14-page document called The House of Elizabeth, which explained to the boys that they could, under no circumstances, sleep with their sisters, and that they all had to leave the house as soon as they were able to support themselves. He ended this document with, "Get a life, find your own woman, as God has commanded."
So clearly, his position on incest being the purest and best way to go, he only meant when he did it. And a lot of the information about what it was like in the Wesson clan comes from journal entries written by Kiani Wesson, who's one of Marcus's daughters and also child brides. And she used the code Daddy was sweet today to mark the days that Marcus raped her. When Weston got bored of raping his daughters, he gave them each a sister wife within the clan to be a friend and lover while he watched. He claimed that he was making the girls better women through this abuse. He was preparing them for marriage, which seems like a strange objective when they're never allowed to leave the house. Like, obviously, there are so many things that are wrong with this and don't make logical sense. But his argument is like, oh, I'm going to make you a really good wife for somebody. But he means him because they're not allowed to, like, leave or do anything.
Exactly. And he keeps marrying them.
Exactly. Like,
when are they going to go find other husbands?
And when the girls got pregnant at various ages, Marcus would tell his sons and anyone else who asked that they had been artificially inseminated.
What? What?
And some of these girls are like fucking 13, 14 years old.
And this is it. Again, he's telling people that they were artificially inseminated. He's not even going the route of just saying like, oh, well, you know, she slept with somebody at school. We don't know who it is. We're not going to try find it. We're very religious. We don't believe in abortion. She's going to have the baby. He's lying in a way that is so fucking unbelievably implausible, and still no one does anything.
And also, how, I assume, in the United States, that for someone who doesn't have health insurance, which he does not, artificial insemination is going to be incredibly expensive. How is he managing to do it over and over again
exactly.
when they don't have any money?
I know. And I'm just like, what checks and balances are there in place for the welfare of children who are homeschooled? Because you would think if these kids were going to school at 13, if they got pregnant, even by like a 13-year-old boy at school, there would be like a police? There'd be like an officer coming round or a social worker coming round, surely, to be like, who's the dad? Like, we need to
Yeah,
know.
Like, these children have just been completely allowed to disappear.
This is the terrifying thing. When people go off the grid, when they do all of this, like, I get why some people do that, obviously. But, fucking hell, it just makes it rife opportunities for child abuse to go down. And this is a perfect example of that.
So, his sons and Elizabeth claimed that they had absolutely no idea what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that.
No.
At all.
I don't believe that at all. But what I do believe is that they were completely under his control in a way that they couldn't feel like they could do anything and take a step. Obviously, it would have been great if they had, but I understand why. Now, we haven't seen any reliable number of just how big this family got, but it was huge. Because, as we said, Marcus was having these children and then his children were having their own children all of the time. So the Wesson group just got bigger and bigger. And he would reinforce his bonkers ideas by making the group study the Bible 3 times a day, particularly the bits about polygamy, of course. And by repeating that, quote, God's people are becoming extinct. We need to preserve God's children. We need to have more children for God. And he told Elizabeth frequently that she needed to be prepared for the day that the devil with a blue badge would show up at the door and try to take her children away. Psychiatrist Edward Hallowell described it perfectly. He said, quote, what he basically did was create a crucible of fear. He used fear, extreme fear, to get these kids to act completely counter to their own self-interest.
Isn't a crucible of fear such an amazing turn of phrase?
That is. I really like that. Because it's
like as
completely
soon as
accurate.
He came up with that, he was like, I know that's getting in the paper. Well done me, Dr. Hallowell.
And in 2003, Marcus Wesson finally moved his now extremely large family into a real-life actual building. But it wasn't a house. It was an old office block in Fresno, California. Therefore, it was a commercial property in which it was illegal to be living. But realistically, when you look at Marcus Wesson's track record, that really is the least of our worries. And to furnish this brand new office block that he had moved his family into, not brand new, I'm guessing very run down, but brand new for him, he bought antique coffins from a local dealer. And that was where the children would sleep to continue the fantasy of their vampire life. Antiques are super expensive. How is he buying antique coffins?
Apparently, he
Did
agreed...
Did I say
like
antiques are very expensive? I meant coffins are very expensive.
Well,
I don't
both.
Know what I said. Both. Antique coffins?
Yeah, no, he agreed like a payment plan with the guy who was making the coffins. And like, he's interviewed in some of the papers and he's like, yeah, I did think it was weird. Why would you need that many coffins unless you run a funeral home? But again, doesn't do anything about it.
The guy just comes in and buys, like, if he's buying one for all of the kids, let's say conservatively he buys 20 coffins. What? And everyone's just okay with that? Also, what is an antique coffin? Is that a coffin that someone's been buried in and it's been dug up and out of the coffin? Like, why is there an old coffin?
Maybe. I don't know. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought of that. Maybe it's just like a fuck. I don't know. I don't know.
Someone who knows, what's an antique coffin? Tell me.
I'm sure not every kid got one each. I think that's probably like three to a coffin.
Oh, God. That's miserable. Did you know in London there is a two-person escape room in which they lock you both in a coffin and then you can like put your arms through so you can like touch each other's hands to like figure out puzzles, but you're in the dark locked in a coffin?
Absolutely fucking not. Like, that sounds horrific. No way.
I know, right? It's fucking horrendous. So, yeah, I was kind of hoping you'd be like, shall we do it? Because I was going to be like, yeah, cool. But no, never mind.
No, I'm absolutely. I hate being in the dark and I hate confined space. So probably not.
No.
Oh, my God. I went to a bar on the other week. No, I didn't. When was it? Sunday. That's in Shoreditch that used to be a prison. And like the, I can't remember what it's called, but there's like little sort of boothy things where you can go and sit, and they're like legitimate, used to be prison cells. It's really cool.
That's so weird. I've never heard of that.
It's like a proper like bougie, whiny cocktail bar type situation. And there's like a little shop in the front, and that's what you can see in the window. And then you go downstairs and there's like a cinema and then another bar and these like cells.
What the fuck? I thought I knew Shoreditch really well. I have no idea where that is. What? No.
I can't remember what it's called, though.
Okay, tell me later. I want to know. That's extreme.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So, right, basically, he's buying all these antique coffins. We don't know what they are. We don't know where he's getting them. And he's also obviously totally fucking brainwashing his family. But not all of Marcus's family took his word for everything. His niece, Sofina Solario, got the courage to tell Marcus that she was leaving. But when he guessed that it was because of a man, Marcus Wesson stabbed Sofina in the chest and asked her if she was ready to meet God. She said that she wanted to live and would do anything that he said. She would even stay in the house. Sofina survived the chest stabbing, unbelievably for a vampire or a human, one might say. Sofina would eventually go on to leave the vampire clan, but she had to leave her own child behind.
And that's generally what happened. It's kind of not like, I think the daughters definitely weren't allowed to leave and were possibly more controlled by Marcus Wesson than his nieces were, but he was still sexually abusing his nieces. However, a couple of nieces do manage to leave, but the condition of that is that they can go as long as they're not living with another man and they leave their children behind.
Yeah, I think perhaps Marcus starts to realise that it's hard to manage that many people just because you want to. So if anybody's going to go, it will be the nieces. So, yeah.
Exactly. And I really think that at this stage, when Sofina leaves, Marcus Wesson starts to feel the cracks appear a little bit, because not only are people leaving, he's getting letters from the city of Fresno saying, we know you're living in a commercial property and you're going to have to leave. So he's feeling pressure from different sides quite a lot of the time. And like many other cult leaders before him, he's created a plan. to deal with what would happen if it all fell apart. His major concern was that he would be discovered by the police or social services and his family of wives would be taken away and that he would go to prison. And I think that proves he absolutely knew how sick and wrong his behaviour is. The only people who don't are the children that he raised to believe that it was normal. And he pitted those children against each other in a competition that he called Strongest Soldier. His plan was inspired by his total hero, David Koresh. Essentially, if the Wesson vampire clan incest cult nightmare was discovered, then he would pick his favourite daughter disciple to shoot every single one of the children and then turn the gun on themselves. At no point is there a plan for Marcus Wesson to be shot. That makes him a family annihilator and not a cult leader, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I also think, in a lot of places you'll see this described as a cult. It's not really. And we've talked about it like that every now and again because that's what Wesson is trying to build. But it's not really a cult, I don't think, as well. Not only because he was never planning on dying, but also because these are all like people he has power over from childhood. These are all people that are in his family. He never attracts like new people into his cult.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
He never like goes out and like, you know, spreads the word and like has fresh blood. He creates or has created all these people and they've always grown up with him. So he's not a cult. This is a sick family annihilator for sure. And I also think the idea of the like strongest soldier, daughter, disciple shooting everybody, it's very unique for a family annihilator, I would say, because usually they take everybody out. So I think that is the only thing that makes him slightly cultish, because we see that often with cult leaders where they'll have like a second in command that is completely indoctrinated. When he means stronger soldier, he means most aligned with my thinking and most am I able to control. So he treads a line.
And probably the most like likely to go through with it, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the family had been living in the office block in Fresno for about 6 months, but Marcus was keen to leave from the beginning. So he bought an old yellow school bus and get this, like, listen to what's about to happen next. Because when I was reading this, I was like, are you fucking serious? Okay, is everybody ready? So he gets this old yellow school bus, he paints it black, and then he lines it with coffins. Yes.
That's not even the best bit.
No, it's not the best bit. I was pausing for dramatic effect.
Sorry.
Because then he put a hot tub in there. A hot tub and some coffins in a black, pimped out fucking school bus. What the how is nobody noticing? What the hell is going on? Like, I'm baffled. I'm baffled.
It's like Pimp My Ride Vampire Edition. Like, it's just such
exactly.
As the girls get older, like they do go out and work in fast food restaurants and they give all that money to Marcus. But like, where is he getting the hot tub money? Like, I don't understand.
Two things that are expensive, coffins and hot tubs. Funerals cost a bomb. Like, where is all this coming from? I'm absolutely confused. I don't know. Because if it wasn't even that they specifically say antique coffins, I could believe that he was just buying some MDF and making coffin shapes.
Mm.
But like, that's not what he's doing. He's buying
coffins. No, they're like solid mahogany coffins. And also like a hot tub in a bus must be a nightmare to plumb that in. Like, how does that even work?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
Maybe it was actually just like, you know, like that bath that we saw in that Airbnb that was like, oh yeah, hot tub. And it was just a bath over some open flame in the garden. God.
If I find that picture again, which I'm sure I will, because it will be in the group for my birthday chat, I will post it. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. It's so strange. Not to make like light of the situation at all. But you bet Andrea Yates is just like, what the fuck? They were living in a bus and they had a hot tub. Poor old Andrea. Shouldn't have any of that. Anyway, so the plan was, if you're wondering why he's got this magical black goth fucking incest vampire school bus, it's because the plan was to drive the whole family all the way to Washington State to start again. Two of Marcus Wesson's escaped nieces, Ruby Ortiz and Sophina Solario, got wind of his plan, however, to relocate, and decided that they needed to reclaim their children. So they took themselves off to the office block, where they had been forced to leave their children before they had escaped the incest vampire harem. They arrived at the office block on the 12th of March 2004 in the afternoon, with about 12 other people.
This is where things get very, very confusing, because I don't know why they brought 12 other people with them. Maybe moral support.
Yeah, he's a scary guy, like,
So unclear what happens, though. Like, everyone says a different thing. This next bit gets really messy.
So apparently, when they arrived at the office block with their, like, entourage of people to fucking back them, they told Marcus that they wanted their children back, but he refused to hand them over. He told the women that the children were his and they weren't going anywhere. As Hannah said, like quite a lot of this story, it's a bit unclear exactly what happened next, but we've done our best. So after they arrived and asked for the children and he said no, at 2:13 p.m., Ruby and Sophina called the police.
As they stood outside the vampire cult office building, their cousins, sisters and children screamed at them from the windows. They called them Judas and told them to bow down to their master. Marcus Wesson stood outside the office block shouting at Ruby and Sophina. The incident was logged as a domestic disturbance and no patrol cars were sent. Ruby and Sophina then made a second call at 2:23 p.m. The police arrived on the scene at 2:35 p.m. But they really don't seem to have been acting with any sort of real urgency. The police spoke to Marcus Wesson and told him that even though the children were his, he had no way of proving it. He had intentionally left his name off all of his children's birth certificates on account of being either their grandfather dad or their uncle dad. And this meant that Marcus had no legal claim to the children. The officers explained this, and Marcus was calm and cooperative. He told the officers that he would hand over the children to Sophina and Ruby, but he just needed to say goodbye to them first. Basically, the police are just like, well, you know, we're probably going to have to get the court involved and we'll probably come and have to, like, get all the other children out of the house. But, like, this whole thing goes on for 80 minutes, 8-0. Like, there is no urgency at all, even though Ruby and Sophina are like, he's a madman and he's got a gun in that house.
And I assume they're also telling them about all of the fucking rape and the incest and all the craziness that's going on inside.
I don't think so.
God.
I think, but it's so hard to know whether they did and they weren't believed or whether they didn't. But it should be enough to be like, my child is in there. He has no legal claim over him. Like, let me get my kid out of that office block where people shouldn't be living.
I was going to say, maybe instead of trying to, like, get these officers to act with urgency because there's a bunch of children in there with a fucking lunatic with a gun, or maybe they should have just gone the route of saying, hey, this guy shouldn't be living here. And the city's actually been sending him letters about the fact that he's living in a commercial property. No one's been sending him letters about all the kids he's got and about all of the kids he's abusing. But hey, maybe that would make people act with some sort of urgency, because you're right, they clearly just are like, whatever.
So Marcus Wesson, after this conversation, turned his back to the officers and Ruby and Sophina and walked unaccompanied inside the office block. We don't know how many people were inside.
Unbelievable. I cannot believe they let him go back into that office building unaccompanied and just be like, oh, I'll go get the kids. Here I go to go get the kids. Bye. Yeah. Unaccompanied.
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
There are at least 4 police officers and they just let him walk in. As Marcus Wesson closed the front door, Ruby, Sophina and the police stood on the pavement waiting for the children to emerge. This is unbelievable. One of the officers said to Sophina, this is a direct quote, okay, well, you made a big mistake 8 years ago. And he means having a child with Marcus was a big mistake. But he's just like, this is your fault. It's your fault for having a kid with that guy. And now we're all here and I'm wasting my afternoon trying to sort this out for you.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I don't even know what to say to that. It's fucking sick.
The police had absolutely no idea what they were about to witness, as evidenced by their complete lack of give a shitness about the whole thing. This domestic disturbance was about to turn into the biggest mass murder in Fresno history.
Ruby and Sophina heard 2 gunshots. To this day, however, the police claim that they heard nothing at all. After some time had passed, it became clear that Marcus Wesson was not planning on coming back out. Elizabeth came out first, screaming, they're all gone. It was 3:47 p.m. Then Marcus Wesson walked out of the house with his arms in the air. He was soaked in blood and he was arrested on the spot by presumably, you would assume, quite surprised officers. And he was allegedly so fat that they had to use 3 sets of handcuffs to secure his hands behind his back. A SWAT team was sent into the office block to find the source of all of the blood. And they found it in a room that was lined with, guess what? Antique mahogany coffins. What the fuck? I do not understand. And on the floor, they also saw a tangle of arms and legs and clothes. Initially, they had no idea how many bodies were there. but it was clear that most of them were children and that they had all been shot just once through the eye. And here are the names of the children and the people that were found in that office block. Sabrina, who was 25, Lise, who was 17, Illabel, who was 8, Aviv, who was 7, Jonathan, who was 7, Ethan, who was 4, Marshy, 18 months, Sedona, 18 months, and Jeva, 1.
Sabrina and Lise were Marcus Wesson's daughters and wives. Their bodies lay on top of the children, indicating that they had died last. A knife covered in blood was found on Lisa's body, but none of the corpses had been stabbed. The gun was found under Sabrina. According to the coroner, Laura Lee Cervantes, none of the bodies showed any sign of physical or sexual abuse. But DNA confirmed that Marcus Wesson was the father of every single victim. Police at the scene were offered counselling and priests to help them cope with what they had seen. No fingerprints were found on the murder weapon, but it was covered with Sabrina's DNA. Could she have been the strongest soldier? Marcus Wesson was detained on a $9 million bail, and as more information about his twisted family tree was discovered, it becomes increasingly hard to understand how all of this went totally unnoticed by authorities. Wesson was charged with 14 counts of sexual abuse and 9 counts of murder. 500 citizens declined to be on the jury because they couldn't be impartial. The trial began on the 3rd of March 2005. Marcus Wesson initially declined a public defender because he was concerned that they would put in an insanity plea. I'm not really sure what his plan was here, but it's not a massive surprise that the man who had been living off welfare his entire damn life and having sex with his own children did not have the money to hire his own counsel, so he ended up with a public defender anyway. But the insanity plea never happened. Wesson pled not guilty to all charges, but his defence didn't really have anywhere to hide.
The crux of the trial was, who pulled the trigger? Was it Marcus Wesson, or was it Sabrina? And if it was Sabrina, as the DNA evidence suggested, how responsible for the deaths was Marcus Wesson? Elizabeth took the stand and told the court that she was too traumatised by the whole experience to remember anything significant, although she did claim that she had walked in on Sabrina as she lay dying in Marcus Wesson's arms. She gave nothing else away, though. She was supportive of her husband and did not think that any of his actions were wrong. Elizabeth claimed that she had no idea that Marcus was abusing their children. She claimed that they never told her, and how was she supposed to know if they didn't tell her? Obviously, these daughters are, like, continually getting pregnant. So, like, is she not asking any questions about that? It seems very odd. And I do think it can feel very easy to feel like Elizabeth should have done more, should have called the police, should have saved her children. But we have to remember that she had been married to Marcus Wesson since she was 8 years old. She is as much a victim of his sick mind as anyone else.
She's very frustrating because, obviously, like, she's arguably had it the worst because he's been doing what he's doing to her since she was 8 years old, and now she's like a fully fledged adult. But it does feel frustrating when she's just like, I didn't know, I had no idea. How am I supposed to know if nobody tells me?
Of course. It's like we often face in these things. There's no black and white, like, it's a massive grey area. It's heartbreaking. She is a broken person. She's been abused by this man since she was 8 years old. But of course, the other side of you is like, you went on to have your own children. I wish you had done something to protect them. But was she in a place where she could reasonably have done that? Probably not, tragically.
I really don't think she was, because, like, she says in court, she says, according to the newspaper, my whole family, my way of life is not normal. Like, that's complete news to her, which I suppose it must be.
Yeah. Not only did Marcus Wesson do what he did, her mum let him do it from when she was 8. Like, she's not known anything else other than this.
And when she was asked to elaborate further on what she meant by not normal, Elizabeth asked the prosecution attorney why she was such a bitch. Like, she's just asking her questions in the courtroom. She was just like, why are you such a bitch? And also, like, Elizabeth isn't the only one that takes the stand and sort of defends Marcus. Kiani Wesson, the one who wrote the journal, took the stand and she told the court that there was nothing wrong with a father having sexual contact with his daughters and that the whole family had agreed to live and die for Christ, but that was only a figure of speech, really.
Yeah, and anyone obviously can be like, oh my God, how can she say this? fucking hell, she's his daughter. She's not known anything else, even more than Elizabeth. Elizabeth had 8 years before this. We don't know what she was going through in that time. But Kiani is born into this. Of course she thinks there's nothing wrong with it, because that's what her father slash husband has told her entire life. It's so sad.
Marcus Wesson kept himself for the whole trial, apart from one outburst where he just shouted, "Objection, the prosecutor is angry." He was sharply reminded by the judge that he was not in charge and to keep his mouth shut, which he did. He also played an imaginary piano and wrote a country song about his 9 dead children. In the courtroom, he literally is sitting there next to his attorney, pretending to play an invisible piano.
He's clearly not well. And I actually think a big indicator of the fact that he's not well is that he doesn't want to plead insanity.
Yeah, that's true. That's a really good point. Rosa Solario, so that's Safina's sister, proudly wore her wedding ring throughout the trial. So he's not unsupported. The jury deliberated for 2 weeks and found Marcus Wesson guilty on all counts. Even if he did not pull the trigger, it couldn't be argued that he wasn't responsible for the whole incident. No one knows when the children were shot. No one heard 9 gunshots. The police still claim that they didn't hear any at all. Which, like, so the argument is that the children are already dead when the police arrive. And then the 2 shots that Safina and Ruby claim they heard is Lise and Sabrina. I don't understand how the police cannot have heard it.
They did. I'm convinced of it. I'm sorry. Like, of course they did. It's just, if we say we didn't, it excuses the fact that we completely misinterpreted a scene that needed to be dealt with much more severe urgency.
And how are 9 people, children and adults, being shot with no one here? Because, like, okay, so if we say that the police are just lying and they those 2 shots definitely did happen, where are the other 7? How did no one hear them?
Is it noisy? Do they live in like an abandoned bit of like a office-y area? I don't know. If it's an office-y area, did they do it at night and it's not residential? I don't know. Like, there's lots of questions. But I can buy that a lot more than if Safina and Ruby heard 2 shots and the police officers are saying they didn't. I don't believe that. But anyway, Marcus Wesson was sentenced to 102 years in prison for the molestation charges. And for the 9 counts of murder, he was sentenced to death and packed off to San Quentin, where his dreadlocks were shaved off, partially because they're not allowed, but also because he had been masturbating and wiping his semen into his hair.
Mm-mm-mm. You thought we were going to quit with the armpits,
nope,
didn't you?
They
sorry, guys.
Have that one for nothing. And Marcus Wesson would never receive the death penalty, though. Governor Gavin Newsom signed a moratorium on the death penalty, sparing Marcus Wesson's life years later. But you will be glad to know that he will never be eligible for parole. Many of Marcus Wesson's children defended him even after he was in prison. One told the press, quote, "It was a nice way to grow up. I can't name another 19-year-old who has no record and obeys his parents." Elizabeth and Kiani now live with the journalist who reported on the story and took pity on the lost women. And I honestly, I have no idea how they would even begin to heal from this level of abuse. My heart breaks for them. And yeah, this journalist, who is this journalist? That's incredible. Just like taking these 2 women. What?
Yeah, we can look at it as like a great, like, good Samaritan move, but she's also kissing goodbye to her fucking journalism career. You can never put yourself in a
very,
story.
Very odd. I don't know. But yeah, that happened. So Elizabeth also stayed in contact with Marcus Wesson for a while. But apparently, as of now, they are no longer communicating.
I think a few of them sort of like during the trial and whatever, Elizabeth and his sons and Kiani were sort of stuck by him. But then obviously, as they've been out in the world more, they've perhaps realised what actually happened to them and they're not really siding with him anymore.
Of course. And I also think that kind of control that he was playing out needs constant topping up, needs constant reinforcement. Once he's out of the picture, that is going to ease, that's going to dissipate, regardless of what they're sort of told by other people. But what is good to know is that they are truly removed from Marcus Wesson, because none of his family have ever been to visit him in San Quentin, where he is still today. So that's that, the story of fucking Marcus Wesson, the vampire king. Self-proclaimed vampire king.
You're right, self-proclaimed Cleopatra.
Yeah, well... That's pretty rough. Hopefully you're still there. And yeah, $5 and up patrons. We're going to try lighten the mood, take it over to Under the Duvet where we'll have the after show party. Come over and hang out with us there. If you would like to do so, you can go over to patreon.com/redhanded. Take a look at the rewards, take a look at the tiers, sign up for what you think A, you can afford, and B, what you think we deserve, if you would like to. Other than that, you can come follow us on all the social medias at Redhanded the Pod. Buy your tickets to come watch us at Podcast Live. It'll be fun. It'll be a good night. We'll have drinks with people after. It'll be jokes. So hopefully we'll see you there. Other than that, here are some lovely, lovely people to say thank you to for their Patreon love. Okay, right. Let's do this. I'm going to nail it today. I have a feeling. So thank you very much, Miri, C.D. Paul, Mike Van... God, thanks, Mike. Dorviert. Dorviert? Yep, I think so. I think you're from Amsterdam. No, not Amsterdam. Netherlands. I think you're from the Netherlands. Yeah, I'm going to go with that. Kathy Baker, Daniel Mills. And I wasn't just saying that about Mike because of his surname. He could be from here. It's because he tweeted at us and he came to the London show all the way from the Netherlands.
Oh, what?
I know. I remember his name.
Oh.
Thanks, Mike. Jamie Traheer, you're back again. Hello, Jamie. Kate O'Donoghue, Sarah Reidman, Lindsay, Rachel, Amelia, Nicole Dirks, Dahlia Salmon, Alish Harris, Merilee, Kay McKellar, Kat, Alexandra Emiko, Alexandra Chatterley, Mara Friedman, Emiliana Lozano. God, you guys have got such exotic names. Sally Quinn, Miranda, Hester Zarecki, Anna Harville, Ellis Lovett, Mackenzie McDaniel, and then Hannah can go.
Oh, what? There's
all
so
right,
many.
All right, all right. Stacey Ford, Devin Knorr, Jennifer Lewis, Tess Smith Roberts, Gemma. I just get shorter and shorter every time with the number of names I do. Gemma, Jenny Monroe, Kyle Huston, Sarah Hoskins, Earl Biggersworth. Biggersworth? Wow. Earl Biggersworth. Yeah. Anita Cowman. Oh, man.
Okay, fine, I'll do
good.
It. It's just because we're so hilariously behind that I just had to like smack loads in. Kielielu Murti Miller, Tanya Lichtensteiger, Rebecca Lee. That's not a
Sneha.
Word.
It's an Indian name.
Oh, shit, fuck. It's so racist.
That's why I'm here. Don't worry.
Sarah Roberts, Caroline Chadwick, Claire Mai, Chris Harvey, Aaliyah, Tiffany Kupia, Julie, Jason Baskerville, Sarah Beche, Ashley Fellows, Erin Rennie, Neve Murray, Mercedes Shriner, possibly, Lindsay Kleinknit, Trettle, Sarah King, Anna Melia, Bernice Sanchez, Emma Self, Cohen Enright, Amelia, Rochelle, Kelly Hill, Natalie, Bernice Kutemarsh, Matt Braunschneidel, Jojo Popcorns, Freya Bennett, Adrian M, Sophie Hood, Flocko Rock, Nicole Salvage, Lexi Reed, Megan Grubbs, Daniel Flores, Kate Rubin, Atia Hira, Bria Sminsmansky, Stacey Russell, Claire, Megan Parker, Naomi, Maria Gonzalez, Lothar, Kerry Beccatini.
Beccatini? There's no N.
I know. Candice, Acevedo, Kat, Laurie Smith, Louise Patterson, Molly Barrow, Chessie Lewen, Nikki Garnham, and Shelby. Oh my God, how did we make it through that?
I don't know.
But we did.
We did. And if you think that we haven't done your name yet, we probably have. We've just said it wrong. So go back and listen to all of our episodes and find yourself there. Otherwise, we will see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.